And welcome to the next installment of our Basic Policy Debate Instruction video series. And today we're going to be talking about how to write an affirmative case, select it, and the things that go into an affirmative case. My name is Alfred C. Snyder. I'm the Edwin W. Lawrence Professor of Forensics at the University of Vermont, and I want to be everybody's debate coach. With me today is Andy Ellis. Good to have you here, buddy. Andy's the debate coach at the University of Vermont. You're also in charge of our website, mm-hmm. and I understand you're the genius behind global internet debating.
Well, you could say that. You have a large
brain. Okay. All right. So you have to be affirmative half the time in these debates, and it's something that's predictable. It's something you can really be prepared for. And generally, with new debaters, I like to tell them, if you get ready to debate on the affirmative, then you'll survive the tournament. You may not know how to debate on the negative, but it's one place where you can prepare and know that your preparation will help. So being affirmative is cool. And there's a number of reasons by that. One is, you get to set traps for the negative team.
Yep.
You get to set traps.
You get to place the cards and the arguments in the affirmative that you want to have that.
Mm-hmm. Also, you can pick an affirmative case that you believe in. Something that you really believe that you can advocate. Now, not every debater and every debate coach agrees that that's a good policy. What do you think, Andy? Does it help to debate, have an affirmative you believe in?
Certainly. I think that having an affirmative that you believe in helps because it allows you to know what the arguments will be out there, and it allows you also to keep it literature that you'll be interested in that you'll actually be reading, so that you're not doing the drudgery work of having to read cards for your affirmative that you're not interested in the literature for.
Mm-hmm. And by cards, you mean pieces of evidence and items of research?
Right.
Okay. So when people say cards, they don't necessarily mean like the ace of spades or the deuce of clubs. They mean pieces of evidence that you use in a policy debate to support and prove your argument. And you'll have to find some cards, some pieces of evidence to build your own affirmative case. Many of you, the first time you debate, will receive an affirmative case from your coach, from somebody who went to an institute, from a more experienced team, and there's nothing wrong with that. But at some point, you should take control and try to write your own affirmative case. But even if you receive one from someone else, you need to know what the components are of an affirmative case and what goes into it. Probably the most important place to start is writing the first affirmative constructive speech. And that's really the only speech in the debate where it's completely scripted, where it's completely prepared before the debate starts. And what are some general guidelines, do you think, Andy, to think about in building your affirmative case?
Well, I think that one of the things that you want to do when constructing your affirmative is to keep the structure very simple and explanatory. I think that you want the judge and the other team after the first round to understand how your affirmative case works on a basic level. And I think that the key to doing that is to having good pieces of evidence that explain your arguments and to having a structure that is clean and easy to follow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And generally, there'll be several major points that are made in the first affirmative speech. Sometimes they're called contentions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're called observations. Sometimes they're called overviews. Sometimes they're called interviews. Is there any difference to any of that?
There's not really a difference to those things. I think that the only affirmative label that is different is advantage, and that has, we'll talk about that in a minute, I believe, but that is different. Otherwise, observations or contentions or overviews are pretty much all the same thing. They're just a way of presenting the information and a word that the affirmative chooses.
There are several basic hurdles that the affirmative has to get over in the first affirmative constructive speech, and that's what you should use for your contentions or your major points. A first affirmative speech, for example, should have, you know, three or four major points that you're trying to make.
Right.
And they should coincide with the basic stock issues that you need to cover in the debate. Now, previously, Justin and I talked to you about the stock issues and what they were. Let's talk about how you would put them into a first affirmative speech. And I guess you have to start by identifying a problem, mm-hmm. or a difficulty, some crisis or a problem or shortcoming that needs to be addressed. What are some of the things they should keep in mind there, Andy?
Well, I think that when you're constructing the advantage or constructing the observation about inherency, you need to have evidence that says the status quo or that will not do the plan that you're proposing, and that way you protect yourself from the inherency claims. But I think that you should also try to put evidence in there which indicates that the harms of doing it the status quo way, not just pieces of evidence that say the status quo won't change, but that the status quo does it in a bad way, yet it won't change. Mm-hmm. And I think that provides a powerful inherency observation because it attacks the nature of the argument that says that the status quo will deal with it, but it also gives you some harm to the status quo not dealing with it. And I think that is the way to construct that contention.
So every affirmative speech should have an inherency contention.
Yeah.
And the inherency contention should basically explain why the status quo is not solving this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Why does this problem continue? What are the barriers that exist to solving this problem? And there's a couple of basic types that people use. Sometimes people will base their inherency contention on attitudinal barriers. Congress doesn't want to solve this problem. Parents don't want to use experimental techniques. Voters are opposed to solving the problem. Corporate lobbyists. So there are various attitudes that exist in our society that stop the problem from being solved. That's one. A second type of inherency would be a structural inherency. And this is where you say that there are specific laws or structures that you can point to that stop the problem from being solved. For example, if you say that the problem is that people can't use vouchers to send their students to religious schools, and it would be good if they did that. That's what the affirmative is saying. The inherency could be that court decisions prevent vouchers from being used at religious school. Government money can't be used at religious schools. That's the separation of church and state. So that would be a structural barrier. There's a law that gets in the way. So the two most common kinds of inherency are attitudinal inherency and structural inherency. And once again, inherency is often confused, and inherency answers the question, why does this problem continue? So it identifies the barriers. So we've got our first contention, inherency. What could we use for a second contention?
I think for the second contention, you would probably want to spell out the harms of remaining with the status quo and the advantages that the plan would accrue if it were to change the status quo. And I think that the way to do that is to provide either specific scenarios, if that is the way you choose to debate, or to provide your broad-based harms card to say it causes these problems, and these problems. And again, when I refer to cards, I'm talking about those specific pieces of evidence that you have to go read in debate rounds.
Well, it doesn't have, some harms are different.
Right.
Some harms are fairly easy to understand, like dollars lost, or people who get sick, or people who die. They're things that we can all agree are bad things, and you can number them. You know, 43,000 students, are unable to get a job because of a certain kind of educational practice. So you can both number it and say that it's important. But there are other kinds of significance or harms that are a little less easy to number. They're qualitative things like happiness, freedom, equity. And all of these things are important. Money's important, lives are important. Those are pretty basic values we have, but there are more abstract values like fairness, liberty, justice, which are just as important because, after all, people have been willing through time to give up their lives for liberty and justice. So they're both very important. And of course, the affirmative wants to strive to have as big an advantage or identify as big a harm as possible.
Right. The affirmative wants to either solve as big of a harm as they can or solve a small enough harm that they don't affect anything that would cause disadvantages.
Generally, it's in this contention, the significance contention, that you'll find some of the more emotionally loaded words. If you're talking about tens of thousands of children who died from some disease, or people who experience spousal abuse or people who are victims of rape. And don't be afraid to give the significance that you have in your second contention here for the affirmative. You know, load it up with emotional language. Make it sound like it's really important.
Finally, I think that you can blend the qualitative and the quantitative problems. You can say, for example, that you solve the subjugation of tens of thousands of students to a certain type of teaching, and that it has quantitative impacts because it affects a certain number of students, but the impacts that it have are happiness or quality or freedom of speech.
Right, because they both go together.
Right.
They're both ways of looking at it. And, of course, in comparing the advantages, the affirmative wants to build up as big an advantage as possible so they have a lot to put on their side of the scale. At the end of the debate, the judge will say, well, what do I get when I vote affirmative? And what are the disadvantages of voting affirmative? So you want your case to have as big an advantage to solve as many harms as possible, and that will help you strategically in the debate.
Right.
Well, every debate, policy debate, it's called policy because it asks the affirmative to do something, and that's generally known as their plan. So the next part of the first affirmative speech we want to talk about is the affirmative plan. And the affirmative plan is really the pivotal point of all the other arguments in the debate, isn't it?
Yeah. The affirmative plan to me strikes as the focus of the debate because it is what the affirmative is proposing to solve all the problems that they've outlined. And the evidence that they will read that says that their plan does in fact solve those problems will rely specifically on that plan. So writing the plan is very important, and you have to write the plan, and there's several things to keep in mind when you do that. The first, I think that you want to mirror the resolution as much as possible. If, for example, the resolution says the United States federal government should help our this year's education topic, you'll want to include the resolution in it and then have your plan be a subset or an explanation of that. That way, it makes it look as if your plan is definitely an attempt to implement the resolution.
And I think that's important because your plan is supposed to be an example of the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
If the resolution says that that we should have educational policies to increase academic achievement, then the plan you use has to be an educational policy to increase academic achievement.
Right.
Well, whenever you talk about doing something, there are basic elements to it. The first is, who's going to do it? Right? You need to have an agent, somebody who's going to do something. The federal government's going to do it, or maybe the federal government's going to do it in cooperation with the states, or maybe the federal government is going to force the states to do it, or maybe it's a foreign policy issue. So generally, it's the federal government. Sometimes you want to identify which part of the federal government. The Department of Education will do this, or the Department of Defense will do that. So you need an agent. And the agent has to do something. And the agent in the plan should take some kind of action. And that is really where you describe what your plan is going to do. For example, you could say, our plan is going to require all schools to give graduating seniors a comprehensive test. And if they don't pass, they can't graduate. So you need to try to explain what it is you're going to do. We're going to make them take a test. How? How many times are you going to do it? Everywhere. Right? How long will it take to implement it? Well, you may want to wait till the next school year to implement it. But in your action, it's important to remember how long is it going to take. Sometimes when you outline an action that you're proposing, you'll advocate a model or a process that's been suggested by someone else. For example, you could say, we are going to adopt the recommendations for a graduation test put forward by Professor Longstreet of the University of Texas. Why would you want to have something like that in your plan?
Well, because that way you don't have to make some of the smaller explanations of things that you were talking about. And oftentimes, you'll have an author who, Longstreet in this example, would in your solvency contention likely explain exactly how his model works. And I think that's an important thing to remember when constructing your affirmative cases, that you can always look to the way that the author suggests to implement the program. And if that works for you and for your strategic purposes in the 1AC, then you should try to stick to that, because it will avoid a lot of the solvency type of debates that you would have otherwise. And I think that advocate is really important to constructing cases when you're younger and when you're first learning how to debate, because it gives you the idea of how you should write plain text. And I think that saying, as per this author, as long as you have evidence from that author in there, provides a very good cohesive story to tell of what your plan will do.
Well, the other thing you need anytime you have a policy is you need to have funding. You have to know where the money is going to come from. You should probably also have an idea of how much it's going to cost. Maybe not the precise dollars and cents, but at least some range of how much your proposal is going to cost. Then also, anytime you have a law, you have to enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have punishment. If people refuse to go along with the plan or violate your policy, there has to be some way of enforcing it to making sure that people go along. Now, often, Andy, people say that we'll use normal means for funding and enforcement, and that's something that many new debaters ask. What is normal means? What do you think normal means is?
To me, normal means just describes it as the normal working of the government. It won't come from special money allocated for the plan. It will come from a budget hearing, as the government would do, and the enforcement will be the same as it is for any other federal law that's passed. If you violate it, then the enforcement stage steps in, and the argument there that I think that it's safe to say normal means in most cases, because you were just advocating that the United States federal government do another policy within the same mindset that it does the majority of its policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's all normal means is.
Mm-hmm. And you can find out what normal means by looking at your government textbook,
mm-hmm,
or your civics textbook. Find out how does a bill become a law, and you'll find out how your plan can become a law. Well, now that you have a plan, we've got the first contention is the status quo is not dealing with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
The second contention identifies the harm or the problem that exists. Third, we propose a plan to solve that problem. And finally, the final contention is to prove that the plan actually will solve the problem. And of all the issues that come up in the first affirmative speech, this is probably the one that will be argued about the most by the negative team.
Right. I think that the solvency evidence should be very much tied to what the plan indicates, as we talked about earlier. I think that that allows you to have you don't run into problems that way with your author disagreeing with your solvency, or you not actually solving everything your author says. As long as you can stick to your author's advocacy, then I think that it becomes easy to put together a solvency contention that answers the basic questions of how the plan will work. How does it work, and why does it solve the problems that you've outlined, I think is an important question.
And that's something that you also need to make sure the judge understands.
Yes.
In the debate. You want the judge to understand how your plan solves the problem that you've isolated.
Right.
So you need to explain that in your own words, as well as have evidence that does that.
Right, and I think that the other thing that the solvency evidence can do is it can tell some of the internal link stories of what will happen when the plan is passed. When I say internal link, I'm talking about the arguments that connect one piece of your argumentation to the other argumentation. Those are when the authors make the extrapolations from, now we must do this, it will cause this to happen. And I think that those are really important to constructing a good solvency story. And I think that if you know your solvency and you're very well researched on your solvency, then the rest of the debate becomes easier, because you're confident at that point that you can solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. I think that you want to have your strong solvency evidence, and then that pretty much completes your first affirmative speech.
Mm-hmm.
Your first affirmative speech should establish inherency, why the status quo is not solving it. It should outline the problem that exists that you're going to try to solve. It needs to have a plan to solve it. And finally, you need to prove that your plan will work. Sometimes you do other things as well in the first affirmative speech. You'll include other pieces of evidence for other reasons. And most of those are defensive, aren't they?
A lot of those are defensive evidence so that the 2AC can have more time explaining and less time having to read the evidence. Oftentimes you can include the evidence in there that says, for example, that the federal government and the state government could cooperate in order to implement this policy together. That becomes a perm answer for your 2AC when they read their federalism or their state's counterpoint that says, no, look, we already read the solvency evidence that says that they can cooperate together. And I think that the things that you think are the most likely to be the negative arguments against you, you would like to have some 1AC piece of evidence that you can refer to in order to answer that, in addition to new evidence that you can read in the 2AC.
Yep, it's a very good idea. Think of evidence that you will have to read in every debate in the second affirmative constructive, and put it in the first affirmative constructive to save yourself some time. It also makes you look good, as you mentioned. Look, we already proved that that's not relevant or not true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what goes into a basic affirmative case. And eventually, debaters get around to selecting and preparing their own affirmative case. And in selecting an affirmative case, you're just have decided we want to write our own affirmative case. What are some things that you should keep in mind?
Well, I think that the first thing that you should keep in mind is where the literature base is on the affirmative you want to write. If the majority of the evidence that you have seen, for example, goes the opposite way of the affirmative, and says that doing the claim that you propose would be a bad idea, but you have a few pieces of evidence that say it's a good idea, you'll probably want to stay away from that debate. I think that you want to stay in the debates where the literature debate base is large enough that you can get the evidence that you need to win the round, but it is not too large that you can lose control of it.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you know what they're going to, as long as you can have some predictability of what you think they can say, then the affirmative can be constructed very strongly.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the research about your potential case area, let's say it's school uniforms,
mm-hmm.
you would look at some articles, read them, and see, are they mostly affirmative? Are they mostly negative? What's the negative say? And if you don't mind answering the arguments that you find against your case and you think they're good answers, then that's a good example of an affirmative case you might want to pick. I think you also want to pick something that you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
That's because I think you do a better job debating something you believe in. You're fully committed to it, you're less likely to contradict yourself, and you're excited about giving your speech, and it really makes you a more effective advocate.
Sure.
Don't be afraid to use an affirmative case that's different than ones that other people have.
Right.
If you run an affirmative case that everyone else has, it's hard to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two sides to that. I think on the one hand, you can have a relatively predictable debate if you run an argument that other people run all the time. You can know which debates you need to be on top of in order to win that. However, the debate then doesn't become about your affirmative. And I think by picking the smaller affirmative as you advocate, and I think it's a good idea, you get to center the debate around your affirmative, which is really what you need to do when you are on the affirmative. You need to keep the debate focused on your speech and your arguments, not on theirs. And I think that a strong, small affirmative can do that better than a big one.
So another piece of advice that I give to debaters is look and see what the most popular generic arguments are on the topic.
Mm-hmm.
Look and see what the negative team says almost in every debate. And then pick an affirmative case that easily answers or turns the tables on that argument. And then that'll give you a lot of strategic advantage. Because some negatives will just go ahead and use their normal arguments no matter what. And if your case is designed to defeat and answer that, they'll be in big trouble.
The other thing is with that you can force negatives into ground that they would not normally take arguing. And I think that's very important because if you're, say, debating round three at a tournament, you've already run your affirmative twice, you know your affirmative really well, whereas that other team who has been running their arguments that don't link to your affirmative if you have a small one has to relearn and debate all of these arguments for the first time. And that gives you an immense strategic advantage on the affirmative. Know your affirmative and you'll win more rounds than you'll lose, certainly.
Okay, so now that we've given some guidelines about how to select an affirmative case, people have to prepare an affirmative case. And that's all about research.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, I want to have an affirmative case about giving out ice cream cones to everyone at lunch. You have to start by reading something about the policy discourse that exists in that field. And I think research is absolutely essential to writing your own affirmative case so that you will understand it and be able to defend it. But many students say, does that, doesn't that mean I'll have to read dozens of books and thousands of pages? I don't think that's really true. Do you?
No, I don't. Because I think when you get the, when you get a book from the library that you want to read for your affirmative, it's unlikely that every chapter of that book or every section of that book will be something you need to read. If it is, then that's a book that
you need
to, that's good. That's a book that you need to focus your research on. But I think that you'll come across a lot of times chapters or certain journal articles, and you can read a very a smaller amount of literature than you may think and still be able to be up on a topic, because you don't have to read whole books. You don't have to read journals. You just have to read the very specifically focused articles about your case. And there are never enough of those that you could be overloaded with the research.
Yeah. I advise people to do what I call scanning.
Mm-hmm.
You take a book, you look at it, you see, is this going to be relevant to my affirmative, to the argument I'm researching? And if it is, go to chapter one and read the first paragraph. And if it seems like the rest of it is going to be, that chapter is going to be pretty good, then just read the first sentence of every paragraph. And if you read a first sentence that looks really good, then you want to read the whole paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you should read the last paragraph of every chapter, because sometimes it sums up and you'll see if there's things you missed. The other thing is, if you're looking for something specific, you can use the table of contents. Say, well, there are a bunch of chapters about things. Now, this chapter looks like this is the one I want. So you read that chapter closely. Or you can use the index in the back of the book and look up what it is, school uniforms, if that's what you're researching, and then find it. So you have to, you know, don't be afraid and think that you're going to have to read dozens of books and thousands of pages. You can learn to scan through the books and just find the stuff that you want. Articles, it's the same way. You don't necessarily read the whole article. You scan the paragraphs and you read the beginning and the ending of the article, and you see if it's good. And if it's good, you read the whole thing.
Yep.
Sometimes there are things that don't just take the evidence that's good for your affirmative case.
Right. Always make sure you know the negatives, and sometimes cut the negative arguments, because other people could have had the same idea.
Absolutely.
If you have an author who is advocating your case, it's likely that other people will have found that author too at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So always take the negative evidence into your own case, because it'll help you understand.
It'll also allow you help when writing the front lines. You'll know what are the answers to their arguments.
Yep. Tune into the later tape in this series on evidence, and it'll help you understand how to do that. When they go to sort the evidence, I just recommend a simple, make some simple piles: inherency, significance, solvency, negative. And then you can just sort it that way, and you get an easy sort of the evidence after you've processed it. After you've done some research, one of the most important things you want to do is look and see not necessarily what you have, but what you don't have.
Mm-hmm. I think the process of identifying what you need and being able to find it is perhaps more important than the process of finding the initial affirmative argument. Because at the point that you come to that level where you have to identify what you need to make the decisions about what targeted research you're going to do. And at that point, that's when the things that you'll learn from the research video that we do will come in really handy when you're finding those specific pieces of evidence that you need. But let me implore, don't spend too much time on this process, because the card that you need or the evidence that you need may not be findable. You may just need to find another way to craft your affirmative around not having that answer. Be ready for that, because if you can't find it, then it's likely that the other team will pin you down on that and you'll have to defend it. That doesn't mean the affirmative is bad. It just means that you have to restructure how you're going to defend it.
Well, you're going to be affirmative half the time, so you might as well get ready. We talked about the basic components that go into your first affirmative speech, how to select one, and how to prepare. And that pretty much takes us through the content for our first visit with the affirmative. In our second visit with the affirmative, we'll be talking about how to give the second affirmative constructive and the affirmative rebuttals, and some tricks of the trade on how to win on the affirmative. Well, thanks a lot for watching us. Thanks a lot for being with me, Andy. And we'll see you later. Don't forget, keep on debating and don't give up.